Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Robert Rosenthal, the Executive Director of the Center for Investigative Reporting. And I'll be your moderator for today's program called Witness to the Guantanamo Project. We also welcome our listening and internet audiences and invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Peter Jan Honigsberg. Peter Jan Honigsberg started as an activist, really, I think 50 years ago when he was a student, a law student, and in the civil rights movement, when he went to Bogalusa, Louisiana, to help civil rights workers. So this is a journey for him of passion that he's continued for many years. He's been on the faculty at the University of San Francisco Law School for 20 years. And after 9/11, he started teaching a course called Terrorism Post 9/11, which I think led him to the Witness to Guantanamo Project, which he's going to tell us about today. And now I'd like to welcome our distinguished guest, Peter Jan Honigsberg.
Thank you very much, Robin, and thank you very much for coming today. I really appreciate it. It's always exciting to see an audience come, because I have to tell you that when I tell people about the work I'm doing, interviewing people around the world about Guantanamo, the usual reaction is, well, Guantanamo is closed. And in fact, that's what most people seem to believe. Unfortunately, the people who come to hear me speak know better, and maybe a few others do, but many people, having heard President Obama say that he's closing Guantanamo on the second day of office, think he did close it. And even though he's repeated it three more times, people still think it's closed. In fact, George Bush intended to close it, so he said, and John McCain, when he was running for presidency in 08, said he would close it, so people do believe it's closed, but it's still very much alive, and unfortunately, his legacy continues to inform U.S. policy and culture, actually, to me. What I have done for the last 7-8 years is go around the world interviewing former detainees and others who are involved with Guantanamo, people who have lived or worked in Guantanamo, or family members of the detainees. So we started out by interviewing former detainees in 5 countries back in the summer of 09, and then we started interviewing interpreters, interrogators, prison guards, chaplains, military officials, government officials, psychologists, medical personnel, anybody else we could grab a hold of who'd be willing to talk to us on film. No one else in the world is doing this work. These people, some of these people have been interviewed by others, journalists, and actually by a couple other academic institutions, but no one has gone around the world and filmed them in 2-3 hour interviews. And unfortunately, I wish someone else had done it, because we're really tiny. We're here in San Francisco. We're really not equipped to be doing it. It should have been done by some large organization that is totally well-funded and has the personnel. When I started this back in 08, I knew nothing about interviewing. I knew nothing about filmmaking. I knew nothing about any of the work that I was doing. Well, I only did it by default because I looked around and nobody's doing it, and I felt that the legacy of Guantanamo was disappearing. If we didn't grab it, we'll forget it. And my parents are Holocaust survivors, and the Shoah Foundation influenced me a lot. Steven Spielberg started that when he was recording people in the 80s and 90s. My father's one of the people he interviewed, people who escaped the Nazi European culture, whatever it was, and I kind of felt we should do the same, because it matters for the U.S. I mean, people don't want to know about Guantanamo now. 25, 50 years from now, it took 60 years to remember about the Japanese internment. It'll take that long to remember about Guantanamo. People really care and do some historical research on Guantanamo. I'll be dead by then, but other people will be alive, and they'll see these videos. And so these stories that we've recorded on camera will be there. The voices will be there to be heard when people are ready to hear them. So what we've done so far is interview 136 people in 20 different countries around the world, and 50 of those people are former detainees. Others are the kinds of people I just described. What I'd like to do, and what I always do when I give a talk, is show a few clips. Now, we have a website witnesstoguantanamo.com, which you can find, and you can find these clips on your website. I'd like to show a few of the clips because really they're the voices that we recorded. As I said, the interviews are usually about 2 hours or so. These clips are 2-3 minutes at the most, but they are much more than engaging. They actually, every time I watch them, I am captivated by just listening to the stories these people have to say, and that's my presentation. So I'd like to start with a couple of these clips, and then we'll take some audience participation. People have questions, I hope. Often, actually, I will tell you, after I show about 4 or 5 clips, people are so stunned. Usually no one asks me questions. People just sit there, and that's the end of the presentation. So they're very powerful. But let me start with a woman. This is a sophisticated audience, so you might know who the Uyghurs are. No one knew who the Uyghurs were before they were captured and brought to Guantanamo. They are from China, but they're not Chinese. They actually had their own country, East Turkestan. China overran it the same time it overran Tibet back in mid-century. And 22 of them were in Afghanistan and picked up after 9/11. You probably know, but if you don't know, you should know, that 80-90% of all the people in Guantanamo were purchased by the U.S. They were not captured by the U.S. They were purchased by the U.S. from Afghani and Pakistani soldiers who sold them to us for somewhere between $3,000 to $30,000 each. So people got very rich. We dropped millions of flyers over the country of Afghanistan and Pakistan, telling them, you bring us Al-Qaeda and Taliban soldiers or whomever, bring us anybody, and we'll pay you that kind of money. You'll live well. A typical Afghani made $800 a year, so that kind of money paid off big time. That's the people in Guantanamo, and some of those people we got to interview. So anyway, the Uyghurs were some of these people grabbed because they weren't local. People saw strangers, they grabbed them and sold them to us. We knew right away the Uyghurs were innocent. The Uyghurs actually had a problem with China, which is why they went to Afghanistan to either find a better life or to arm themselves and go back and fight the Chinese over their own country. But we held them because of politics that has to do with China. I can get into it. Maybe if you ask me the question about it, I won't go into it now. The fact is, even though we knew they were, quote, innocent to us, we held them. Eventually, they were released to other countries. They couldn't be sent back to China. If they were sent back to China, they would have been executed. The first people we interviewed were Uyghurs in Albania, and this woman, Rushan Abbas, joined us. She was a Uyghur interpreter. She's actually a Uyghur herself, and she set up these interviews with the 4 Uyghurs we interviewed in Albania. And then we interviewed her later on, and she lived in Guantanamo for a year, working for the U.S. government as an interpreter for the Uyghur. She was the only American citizen who also spoke Uyghur and Mandarin. Subsequently, she realized all these Uyghurs were innocent. She quit the government and joined the lawyers who were defending the Uyghurs and helped get them out. Anyway, her story is incredibly fascinating. And she tells something right now that I think is very telling. I'd like to start with her clip.
The men always say that they had so much faith and trust in the United States government, but turned out to be that was not what they expected, and they were disappointed. I was too. I was disappointed in a legal system in the U.S. and the constitution we have in this great country, how our forefathers built this country on, based on what values. What happened in Guantanamo was not what I understood of the Constitution. I often think that what if, you know, forefathers, they see, they know what's happening today in Guantanamo, how they feel about this. But, and I always have my faith and trust in the government that they are going to correct this mistake and do the right thing, especially when President Obama came to the office. Almost like next day, he announced that he was going to shut down Guantanamo within 1 year. And I was so excited, I had tears in my eyes. Finally, it's going to be corrected. You know, everybody makes mistakes, but the most important thing is who's willing to correct that mistake. But now we are approaching that deadline in a couple of weeks, and it's not going to happen. So those are the kind of things that disappoints me. And I guess my 20 years in the United States, I always want to see the great side of the United States. But then last 8 years, what I have endured, what I have experienced in Guantanamo, was not the side that I want to see of my country here.
I'm going to show you a clip of a detainee we interviewed. He's French, and a friend of ours, actually. We're pretty low budget, although we've actually gotten quite a bit of money over time. Once we were known at the beginning, of course, it was very hard being a small, very, very, very tiny operation out of San Francisco. But interesting, most of our funds come from Britain. They don't come from the U.S. We hardly get any people who want to give us any money in the U.S. But there's some huge funders in Britain who care about this project and have kept us alive, actually. Anyway, this man lives in France, a French detainee who we interviewed, and a friend of mine who speaks French interpreted or translated his interview, and then you hear her voice as the overlay for what he's saying.
Donc alors après ils m'ont mis nu, donc j'étais nu dans cette pièce, hein, dans cette pièce.
So then they undressed me, so I was naked in that room. They set me on a table, they made me lie down on the table, and so then what happened was that they operated on me. The doctor was standing behind me, and he started to operate. And what he did was he put me to sleep. He gave me an anesthetic, but I thought he was going to give me a general anesthetic. But what he did was a half anesthetic, which means that I was semi-conscious. Why? He had his reasons. This way he could go on with the operation, while at the same time, so I could feel the surgery, the pain from the surgery. And at the same time, interrogators were asking me questions. So that is a technique, apparently well documented. Later I found out it was a commonly used technique. At the same time as they were operating on me, they were interrogating me. That meant that I endured the pain of the surgery, while at the same time I was facing two interrogators who were interrogating me and bombarding me with questions throughout the surgery, actually. That's a fact. So that went on for, I don't know, a very, very long time. And at that point, I really was in pain. It was a very, very, very hard time.
So this man who you just heard want to be in shadow. Some of the detainees we interviewed want to be in shadow, in silhouette. Others have been willing to show their faces. Unfortunately, this man has passed as well. He died last year. That story he told is not unique. We've heard it from other detainees where they had some surgery, but they were kept awake and they were interrogated during the surgery. But one of the things that's interesting about Guantanamo, and maybe I'll play a detainee who talks about it, is that Guantanamo was much more of a psychological prison than physical torture. When you think of torture, most people, when you ask them about the word torture, they think physical. But the fact is, Guantanamo, it had its physical torture in it, and there's, you just heard one, and I could set out a number of them. But what Guantanamo really was, according to the detainees we interviewed, was a psychological prison and psychological torture. And they did such things as put people in isolation for long periods of time. There's been studies shown that after 15 days, people never come back if they've been in isolation for more than 15 days. The U.S. keeps people for 30 days and then claims they release them, which isn't quite true either. In Guantanamo, there have been people, and one of the people I'll play for you next, was held in isolation for 20 months. And he survived it, and he'll tell you what one of the stories about that. But that was not necessarily untypical. And one of the other things that the prison people did in Guantanamo is did something called frequent flyer, where they took a detainee and put him in a cell for 2 hours. And then as he's kind of settling in, they come to the cell and say, okay, we're moving you now. So he said, okay. And they move him to another cell, and they put him there. And then 2 hours later, they come back and say, you know what, we're going to move you again. And then they move him a third time and a fourth time and a fifth time. And they do that for 2 to 3 weeks, every 2 to 3 hours. So the man never gets to sleep, but fitfully, and they do that to basically, quote, soften them for interrogation. So that kind of, and one of the detainees, I don't know if I'll have time to show you that today, but one of the detainees tells us that when he came out of Guantanamo, he had no physical scars on him. And when he told people he was tortured, people said, you're not tortured. I see no scars on you. And he said the scars were all inside because it was all psychological. There was no physical action taken on him. It was all the kinds of things that I described and a lot more. But here's another detainee who tells about when he was in isolation and he started losing it. The fact that he survived is actually the story, because, I mean, I know after one day I'd lose it, so I can't imagine how he survived. So I asked him that question.
There was a cell. The cell was a converted shipping container, and that's it, being locked in there for the next 2 years.
By yourself?
Alone, yes.
How did you manage living in such isolation for, sounds to me, what, 18, 20 months?
Well, there's no simple answer to that, really. I think my faith played an important role. It was severely tested, of course. Thoughts of what I planned to do if I get released. I tried to memorize as much of the Quran as possible. As an Arabic speaker, I tried to contemplate more on its meanings than I had ever done before. I asked for human contact with other people. They sent me a psychiatrist. And this was on a couple of occasions when I'd lost my lost my mind, banged my head against the wall, kicked and screamed, just because of being incarcerated for so long and not knowing when I'm going to get out of this place, and everything building up. I think it was an anxiety attack more than anything else. And they sent in psychiatrists, and I remember the first psychiatrist, not the one that I mentioned earlier on, the one who said that she was very upset about Guantanamo, but this one in particular came along and she sat on the opposite side of my cell and she said, have you thought about hurting yourself? I said, no, not in the way that you're suggesting. And then she said, have you thought about removing your trousers, threading your trousers with a sheet, putting the crotch part around your neck so you can make a strong noose, and then tying it to the top corner of your cell and jumping off to commit suicide? I said, no, not until you put that thought in my mind. And I couldn't understand why she told me that. But what I have learned since that time is that 5 people in Guantanamo have died almost identically from that method.
Mozambique, who you just heard, is a British citizen of Pakistani origin, and very, very smart, and one of the intellectuals who will speak about his experiences. He actually wrote a book. What's really interesting about that is that he did not tell this story in his book, and he told the story to us. And in fact, a number of people have told us, they've told us things they've told no one else in the world. Some people told us things they never told their lawyers, but they felt they wanted to do it for history, and they told it to us. So some of the stories we have are unique. Some of them you've heard from other people. I'll play 2 more clips, then we'll take questions, because I could go on. You can imagine, you know, how many clips we have, and given how many interviews you had. But I'll play a couple other clips, and then we'll call it a day. this man is kind of interesting. He was a Colin Powell chief of staff, and his name is Lawrence Wilkinson, and we put him on YouTube, the clip that we have. I'm going to show you, put him on YouTube. He got 5,000 hits the first week. It's a wonderful clip, and he's actually quite well known. And let me just play it.
As I said when I was campaigning for President Obama, close it, shut it down. I don't care if what is there, 172 left or whatever. I don't care if they're all terrorists and they go back to the battlefield. I am not a coward, like apparently 50% of America is. I am not a coward. I have enough resiliency to understand that terrorism will always be with us, always. The best you can do is bring it down to a manageable level. Bring them here and let's try them. And if they're determined to be innocent for whatever reason, release them. You know, this is insane that we allow this to go on. Incidentally, more people die on the highways than have died in every nuclear accident and every terrorist attack combined. But we don't go, you know, excoriate the automobile or highways. Or this is insanity to me. This is the kind of insanity that the politics of fear in particular and bad leadership, lacking courage, brings about. And that leads to tyranny.
If you, any of you, saw Colin Powell when he gave his speech to the UN and to the U.S. about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq before we invaded Iraq, he wrote this speech. And he says it's probably the worst thing he's ever done. He's forever asking for penance for having written it. So a wonderful man, one of my favorite interviews. Very brilliant, really brilliant. So this woman is a lawyer who represented detainees, and she represented detainees who had been tortured. There was something called extraordinary rendition. Some of you might know that term. It's where the U.S. government picked up some people and took them to other countries and had them tortured in other countries in CIA black sites. But other countries sometimes did the torture, and sometimes CIA agents were involved. But these people were tortured brutally, physically, and then brought to Guantanamo. And she represented some of them and worked with some of them. And ultimately, she left. She couldn't do it. She burnt out, I think. It was just too hard on her. And she tells this story about what she had learned interviewing these detainees.
The secrecy around the CIA was so different than anything else in Guantanamo. And it felt as if we were complicit in what happened as lawyers. It really made me question whether we were doing any good as lawyers, because the government could say these men had lawyers, they had access to lawyers, but we couldn't, and we still to this day can't talk about what we know. And what our clients told us was about how the United States government tortured them. I can't go to a foreign country and give a declaration seeking a prosecution of CIA personnel for what they did to my client. I can't do a Pinochet-type action against them because I will be prosecuted. I can't testify in an open hearing what happened. I cannot go to the New York Times and testify and tell them, not testify, but I can't go to a paper and tell them what happened, because there are only a few lawyers who learned this information and we'll all be investigated and we can be polygraphed. So it felt like suddenly my ability as a lawyer was destroyed and that I was being used in a system to conceal torture.
Her name is Gitanjali Gutierrez. She left the country. She said she didn't want to, she told us in the interview, she didn't want to raise her children in this country at this time. She moved out of the country. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to break what I said. I'm going to show one
the
more.
The secrecy around the CIA.
I'm going to show one more clip that's more cheerful. And it's a better note to end on something a little more cheerful than listening to this. Actually, you know what? I'll do him. He's only 1 minute. It's very quick. This man, Clive Stafford Smith, is considered a rock star among people in the legal field. He represented more detainees individually and with a group that he started called Reprieve. Reprieve is in London, and they are miraculous in terms of representing detainees. The Center for Constitutional Rights is the other huge organization that represents detainees, and they're out of New York, and Geeta, who you just saw, worked for them. But let me show you Clive. He speaks for like 50 seconds, and then we'll call it for questions.
Now, if you want America to be safer or Britain to be safer, there's a simple solution. And the solution is to behave decently. You know, it really is true that the effective enforcement of human rights is the greatest anti-terrorism weapon in our arsenal. Because if you behave well, fewer people want to kill you, more people want to help you, and the few nutters who are always going to be out there are going to find themselves very isolated. If you behave badly, you're going to achieve exactly the opposite goal. So, you know, and that's just true. That's just the way the world is. But it's not the way the politicians see it. So we do have a battle. I don't pretend we don't, but we will win that battle.
I'm sorry, I could go on. I'm thinking of three more clips I want to show you, but I'm not going to because I think there's a lot of questions I noticed coming in. If there's time at the end and we need to fill up an hour, I can show a few more clips, but I think I should take the questions because it's only fair to the audience. You're kind enough to come today that I answer your questions, at least try to. I'm not sure I can. And then we can always go back to clips if we need to.
You know, our thanks to Professor Peter Jan Honigsberg for discussing and showing us the clips on for his project Witness to the Guantanamo Project. Now it's time for the question and answer period. I'm Robert Rosenthal, today's moderator, and we have a lot of questions, so let's begin. Peter, can you just tell us what's the status at Guantanamo today? How many prisoners are there? What's happening there, and what do you see coming up?
There are 80 prisoners still in Guantanamo. President Obama said very recently that he'd like to release as many as he can and then send the rest to the U.S. and close down the prison in Guantanamo. That's not going to happen. Congress won't let that happen. And some people believe, I'm one of them, that he could do it on his own, but he's not going to. Loretta Lynch said she's not going to support that, so that's not going to happen, apparently, unless he does it the last day of office and then leaves. But I don't think that will happen. That's not how he has shown his mettle any time before then, so I just don't think that. So I think it'll continue. And more people will probably be released. They have to find countries to take them. And most of the people left in Guantanamo are Yemeni, and the reason why they're left is because Yemen is a failed state, and Obama won't send them back to Yemen, and so he has to find other countries to take them. That becomes more and more difficult, especially when the U.S. would take no detainees. At one point, the U.S. was going to accept a couple of Uyghurs, the least threatening of anyone, and Congress blocked that, and Obama backed down when Congress kind of made noises. Before they blocked it, he made noises. He still could have done it. He backed down. And so countries are constantly saying to us, why should we take them if you won't? And it's getting more and more difficult. So some more will be released to other countries. Oman just took 10 a month or so ago. Saudi Arabia took 10, but some of the poorer countries in Europe took some last year. We interviewed someone in Slovakia. Countries that take detainees get paid by the U.S. to supposedly support the detainee, but they don't. These detainees have no life afterwards. I can say more about that later on, but it's not the question you asked me. But the short end of that, Robert, is that it's not going to close. There'll still be people left in Guantanamo. A lot of people think they'll just die there.
And I guess it sounds like you blame Obama in a lot of ways, but was it a convergence of politics and inability to move these prisoners that really kept it open, in your opinion?
Actually, you want my opinion. My opinion is that Obama could have shut down Guantanamo and moved the prisoners out of there the first 2 years when he had a Democratic Congress if he was willing to take on the Republicans who made noise. He could have. He had a Democratic Congress behind him. He could have shut down Guantanamo at that time. Then when the Republicans took office, they did pass legislation that blocked Obama from some of the actions he could have taken, and that's true. And he can blame Congress on some level after those 2 years when it became a Republican Congress. On the other hand, like I said, he did have some powers as commander-in-chief to move those prisoners, and there's some argument that had he stood up, he could have maybe done it, or he could have horse-traded with the Republicans to do something as well. He never, to me, got down and dirty with Republicans to do what he needed to do. He felt there were other issues that were more important to him, apparently. But he did have the authority at one time and the support from Congress. And yes, I'm one of those people who feels that Obama could have done better on Guantanamo.
So, and you, I think one of the things you just said is it's your belief or possibility that some of the prisoners who are there now who are not released will die there. Has Guantanamo come up at all? Do you have any sense of the positions of potential candidates for president on what they may or may not do related to Guantanamo?
All I hear is hawkish phrases from the Republican candidates when they ran. And honestly, I don't really want to give my opinion about Hillary, what she would do with Guantanamo. I don't feel comfortable. I don't know enough about that. I don't even know what Bernie would do. Honestly, I haven't heard that much about them. Guantanamo's off the radar. I'm sorry to say no one cares. And it's funny, I shouldn't have said that, but I would tell people off camera, no one cares about Guantanamo, and they would always say to me, well, we care, we're here. Well, you know what? That's it. That's it. When I give talks, I get as many as in this group, 25, 30 people. I don't get more people coming. I'm sorry to say that it's not on the radar of Americans, and it won't be until a generation or two passes. So no one really is willing to use political capital to shut it down. I don't think so, no.
When you tracked, I think you said you've interviewed 136 people, 50 former prisoners. Are some of these prisoners being held when they're returned, or are they all released, and then how do they begin their lives?
I only interview people once they're released from Guantanamo. I went to Guantanamo in 07, actually, but you're not as a visitor, you're not allowed to interview the detainees. The only one who can talk to detainees in Guantanamo are the lawyers who represent them. Some of the detainees, when they are released by the U.S., are put in prison in the countries they're released to. Some of them are just find housing for them and just put into substandard housing and live there. Most of them, that's what happens. I just wrote a law review article, title of which is I Still Live in Guantanamo, because a lot of the people who have been released think lives are no better. No one's taking care of them. There's no social services. There's no health services. There's no one looking out for them. The only thing that the U.S. government cares about is that they don't become a threat in the future. So they tell the country that they transferred these people to look out, make sure they're not a security threat. But the U.S. government does not care, does not do anything about their health, their social being. And consequently, these people are really lost. As I mentioned, the person we interviewed in Slovakia, he was sent to a town of 50,000 people in the middle of Slovakia. He's Yemeni. He comes from a tropical somewhat climate. He was sent to a town that was snow, and we interviewed him. And he knew there were no other Muslims in the town. There's no mosque in all of Slovakia, so he has no culture at all, no other people to meet. No chance, as he said, to find a wife. He wanted his mother to come, but the U.S. government wouldn't help him fly, and he has no money. He gets $15 a day for food. He says he can only eat two meals a day, if that, on the food, and that's it. That's his life. So he said to me, I still live in Guantanamo. In fact, I had a better life in Guantanamo. I got medical care there. So it's kind of it doesn't end. It doesn't end for these people when they're released. If they're released to their homes and there's family support, then maybe they can enter back into their culture over time. Someone finds them a wife, and maybe it can be move on. And that's true. If they move back to their homes, their lives can get better. What's interesting about that, and I'm sorry to bring this up since you didn't ask me, but it's important, is to understand that a lot of the families won't ask the detainees about their life in Guantanamo. They don't want to hear it. So sometimes the stories they tell us are the first time they got to tell their story in full. When they talk to their lawyers, they often tell little bits of lawyers that the lawyers want to help them in their case. But they've never had the opportunity to just tell their story as they care to tell it. We have no agenda. We're not journalists. We don't care what they say. Let them tell us their story. The less I ask, the happier I am. I want them to just talk. And often they tell me at the end, it was so therapeutic. They had no idea. They had never thought of that, but it was incredibly therapeutic for them at the end of the interview that they finally got that release. They could tell their story to someone who actually was listening. And that's kind of how their lives are.
You know, one of the, I guess, reasons politically Republicans frequently cite not releasing the Guantanamo prisoners is the return, quote unquote, to the battlefield. Did you find any evidence of that? Or did you speak to anybody who talked about how they were going to rejoin jihad or fight against the United States interests?
There's been amazing mixed statistics on that. I mean, there's been a number of different studies, some of which say that the return to battlefield is high. Others say it's very low. I have no firsthand knowledge in terms of that, other than to say that people have said it, and I am certain there have been actually documented cases of some people have gone back to the battlefield against the U.S. Yes, some people have fought the U.S., but as Lawrence Wilkinson says, we understand that. We understand some might do that. Most of these people, as I said, you know, were purchased, so they weren't really that questionable. They were all low-end people. They were not they were all really, if anything, they were thugs. They were really not much more than that. But as Lawrence Wilkinson said, if some of them go back to battlefield, that's the price we pay for being a democracy and caring and doing rights. These people have been in Guantanamo for 15 years without charges. They've just been held without charge. We never charged them with anything. They're just there. There's 10 people who've been charged. You know, that's it. You know, the rest of the people are just there living a life without that's not the way America is. The reason why I'm doing this project, because that's not how I learned about America in high school. That's not what America is. It doesn't just take people and put them in a cell and throw away the key and that's the end of their lives. I'm sorry. That's not how it should be. And someone should know that. Someone should know we did that. We do that, and we shouldn't do it again. So it matters. But I will tell you a story about going back to the battlefield. A couple of people we interviewed in Morocco did actually go back and fight in Syria, not for ISIS, but for the Nuestra Front, which is an al-Qaeda group. They weren't really fighting the U.S. because the U.S. wasn't in Syria at that time, but they did. They both got killed. And, you know, and the third person who was also we interviewed in Morocco was with them. I don't know if he's killed yet. The other two were. But, yeah, I did interview some people who did go back to the battlefield. But as Lawrence Wilkinson says, you know, we need to do better. You know, or what are we, you know, what are we claiming? Even Obama gets that. He says, you know, we are a beacon of human rights. Well, if we really are, then we need to shut down Guantanamo. Sorry, I got too passionate.
No problem. I'd like to remind our listening audience that this is the Commonwealth Club program called Witness to Guantanamo. And our guest speaker is Professor Peter Jan Honigsberg, who runs that project. One of the things you said, and this is a question from the audience, you said Americans want Gitmo closed. And you also said, but we don't want them on our soil brought here. How do you resolve those two points of view?
I didn't say Americans want Guantanamo closed. I don't know that's true. I didn't say that at all. I don't know that that's true. I don't think Americans care one way or the other. And if you ask them, they might even think it should be open if some politician tells them that. So I'm not I don't know that that's true at all.
But I guess what is true is that every time we talk about having a trial in this country, no one wants to bring any of these prisoners here.
They're afraid of them because the U.S. Congress has told them to be afraid. Now, we have serial killers. We even have terrorists in prison in a number of supermax prisons, they're called. One is very well known in Florence, Colorado. We have terrorists there. In fact, I can mention a few terrorist names, but I won't, who are in the supermax in Florence. We have serial killers. We have awful people in prison, and they're not escaping. You can't escape those prisons. It's all politics to me. I mean, we can handle people who, if they are terrorists, if they are dangerous. Like I said, many of these people, you know, if Bush released 500 plus people, if they were that dangerous, why did he release them? you know, and Obama released 200 plus. You know, why did he release them? They're that dangerous. They weren't all that dangerous. Otherwise, they wouldn't have been released. So, you know, who's left? Maybe some of them are dangerous. We can handle it. But the fact is, you know, a lot of this is grist for the politicians, to me.
You mentioned earlier that you saw a pattern or heard a pattern about surgeries where I guess it sounded like anesthesia was not fully utilized, so somebody was semi-conscious and could be questioned. Did you have it when you found out about this? A couple of things. One, were the surgeries warranted, and were they sort of a ploy? And also, can you talk a little bit about the process of finding the detainees and how you would get them to open up with you, and how much time you spent with them? So it's really two parts: were the surgeries warranted in your understanding, and more about the process of the actual interviews and finding the detainees?
You know, I think in the two situations, the one you saw and another one who had a shoulder injury, they could have been warranted, yes. And a third one I know who lost a leg, he also, it was questionable whether he needed an amputation, but it could have been warranted too. So I think there was some medical care that was justified for that. I don't know it was a ploy, Robert. If it was, I didn't hear that. How I got these people, I got them. Well, there's two parts of that question, I guess. The first is I wrote a book on post 9/11 issues before that the University of California published in 2009, Our Nation Unhinged. I went to Guantanamo, as I told you also, in 2007. I met a lot of lawyers doing research for the book and also meeting in Guantanamo. I also met other people. And I called them up after I decided to start this project and asked them if they'd help me find people to interview, and so they were nice to me. They did me favors. I was lucky. I was really lucky. They were willing to give me names of people, and we called them up. Why they talked to me? Some of them talked to me because it was the first time they could tell their story. Some of them talked to me because their lawyers recommended me. Some of them talked to me because other detainees talked to me. What's interesting is there was this, which I wasn't aware of until some detainee told me. The detainees would talk to each other and send emails and said, look, talk to Honigsberg and nobody else. You can trust him because he just lets you tell your story. He's not out there to get an agenda. I didn't know they were saying that, but in fact, one man who spoke to no one else ever, he surfaced for us and disappeared again. He said, I'm only talking to you because of what I just told you. So some people heard about it. Some people just wanted the story. Some people, I was lucky. Really, it was more fortuitous than anything else. I mean, just people. And one thing I also learned, I learned everything, because like I said, I knew nothing when I started, was that there's a window of opportunity. You kind of grab it when you can. So if I hear someone, or if someone just left government or left whatever, I kind of grab them if I can at that moment, because sometimes people talk right then and then they disappear and they don't want to talk ever again. They don't move on with their lives. So part of it is that, too.
Are you still finding and trying and attempting and traveling and interviewing? And do you take part in every interview?
And do I take part? I'm the only person who interviews. I'm not the filmmaker. I bring a filmmaker with me who films it. I'm the only person who interviews. In that sense, I feel, because of my background, I started, as you mentioned, I started teaching a class on terrorism right after 9/11. And because of my being a lawyer and kind of understanding some of the issues and learning a lot, I think at least I kind of had some knowledge of the questions to ask. For what it's worth, I am the only person interviewing. I'm still doing it, but we're slowing down because we pretty much got people who were willing to talk to us, and a lot of people want to move on. We are actually interviewing next week again, and we're probably going overseas again, but I think it's slowing down. We're looking for an archive right now that will hold all the film. And that, I'm sorry, Robert, I'll just say that, and that has been really complicated because we have so much film. We have close to 300 hours of film and, over 13 terabytes of data right now, and we're still not finished, that a lot of universities just can't handle it. They can't handle keeping it up to date. They can't handle processing it. So we're very limited in where we can find an archive to even hold it and to make some promise that they'll keep it up to date as technology changes.
Do you know how many U.S. military personnel have served at Guantanamo?
No. No, I don't.
And do you have you tried? Or I realize you know, I have interviews with as the attorneys who clearly are in a sense muzzled, especially in relationship to what they can say about the CIA. But have you tried to interview, or have you interviewed any former service people who actually served there as guards or medical people?
Yeah, in fact, one of the clips I want to show you, we interviewed several guards and medical people, and I can tell you really quickly, and I can show you clips. But one prison guard we interviewed, this is a really interesting story. He was there this first day when the first group of detainees came, first 20 came on January 11, 2002. Anyway, he met some of the detainees who spoke English. Some of them were from Britain, and he started talking to them, and he got to know them a little bit. He wasn't allowed to talk to them, but he was bored, and he did. Anyway, when he got out, he became a Houston cop. He was from Texas, and that's what he became. And one day, while he's home, he decides to go on the internet, on Facebook actually, and look up the names of some of the people he talked to while in Guantanamo, and their names popped up. And he said, "No way are these guys on Facebook." And so he sent them an email, and they responded. And pretty soon, they were exchanging family photos and talking. And then this man flew to London to meet people he used to guard. And there's a very famous, you can probably see on YouTube, a very famous photo of him with the people he used to guard. He has one of the biggest hearts of anyone we interviewed. We also interviewed several medical personnel. One medical personnel came out so depressed, and I'll save his story, but they're not all cheerful and upbeat like the one I just told you.
I want to get back to a personal question. You mentioned earlier, I guess you said you were the child of Holocaust survivors, and in 1966, I guess you were how old?
23.
And you were a law student at that point at NYU, is that right?
That's correct, yeah.
And you went to Louisiana in the Civil Rights Movement. So clearly, for your whole life, has been very much involved with very passionate, I'll call doing the right thing, thrust of your life. Can you just talk about a little bit about either your childhood or what really got you this place? Because I think a lot of people really would admire what you're doing. You're on a mission, and it's hard sometimes for people to understand how someone can actually do that and continue doing it their whole life.
I can't explain it. I can't. I think you're born that way. I don't think. I think that's who you are, born who you are. Honestly, I don't know what to say. I mean, I know when my parents, well, they wouldn't talk much. I mean, as you know, anybody in World War II didn't talk much, whoever they were. My parents didn't say much at all. I don't know what got me to be so sensitive to the few stories I knew about my parents as Holocaust survivors. I don't know. Honestly, I can't tell you that. I don't know.
Well, in the South in the 60s, did you feel a connection to that 50-year arc to what you're still doing today? I mean, how would you describe that connection in terms of what you saw there in terms of either abuse or what was going on in the American South and what the continuing arc of that in our history in our country and what that means in terms of Guantanamo?
I can just tell you, I wrote another book also published by the University of California Press called Crossing Border Street about my experiences in the South. And in that book I wrote that I didn't know it at the time. I had no idea. I was clueless. I just went down to the South to do civil rights work because I don't know why. I just wanted to do it. But later on, and talking to people, and maybe even while writing the book, it came to me, and that might not be true, but it came to me that what I was really doing was going back to thank the people who saved my parents' lives by going and helping others. I don't know if that's true, but that's what I started thinking. And I'm sorry to say that's the best I can say about what inspired me. It was unconscious at the time, but I know I'm so grateful for certain people who were strangers to my parents. They're people who signed an affidavit for my parents to come to America. They didn't know my parents. If it didn't work out, they would have had to support my parents for 5 years. These are strangers. These are people who took a huge risk. And I want to thank them. And then someone hit my father during Kristallnacht. If she hadn't hit him, he would have possibly been killed. He certainly would have been ruined in lots of ways. I want to thank her. I don't know who she is. And I didn't think of that, but I think if anything inspired me, it's thanking others for saving my parents' lives, and maybe that's why I'm here right now.
That's a good answer. One thing that's helped reform the U.S. prison system now is the awareness of not only the human rights issues, but also the huge cost for the American, you know, housing all our prisoners. Can you talk a little bit about the costs of Guantanamo in terms of dollars and the continuing cost? And maybe if that was higher profile, it might get more attention in terms of this is, I don't know. Do you have any information
on that?
Well,
I do know there's a woman named Carol Rosenberg. She's the reason why you even hear the word Guantanamo. She writes for the Miami Herald. She moved down there 3 days before they brought the first prisoners, and she's been there pretty much ever since. She lives in Miami, but she goes down to Guantanamo. She's there anytime there's an issue. She's always there. She is the scribe of a Guantanamo. She deserves all the accolades of anybody ever. She is a phenomenal woman. We interviewed her, and she's still reporting now. I mean, it's just astounding to me. And she writes about the cost, and she wrote how it was $3 million a detainee last year, and it's up to $4 million a detainee now. And she covers all that. So, yes, it's a phenomenal amount of expense. But you know what, Robert? I don't think people care. I don't think you could say it's – Obama said it. You can say it's $10 million a person. You can say it's $100 million. They don't care. They don't care about Guantanamo. It doesn't matter to them. They don't think that means we should shut it down. Money, I'm sorry. I don't see it. I don't see that affecting it. But, yes, the money is outrageous. $4 million a detainee? I mean, really? It costs $70,000 to $80,000, $90,000 for a prisoner at Supermax. So, I mean, where's the connection? I mean, it's so outrageously different. It's, you know, you wouldn't believe it. Do you see anybody rising up and saying we need to shut Guantanamo down because of the cost? I don't see it. I don't hear it.
So I think a lot of people have an image of Guantanamo as obviously it's part U.S. territory within Cuba somehow. But how do you go? How do you get permission to go there? Can you just go to Guantanamo? Where do you stay? Do you have to get a special visa? You have to go through the – how do you get in? How does someone go to Guantanamo?
Only journalists can go to Guantanamo. You could go. Only journalists can go, or lawyers for the detainees, or interpreters for the detainees. So I went as a journalist in a sense because I had written books and articles, and they decided that even though I wasn't a journalist, I was close enough as an author. They accept authors to allow me to go. So that's why I was able to go. And they had at that time special planes that went. Now you have to fly a military plane. That time there was some. I don't know. It was some airline called Air Sunshine. I don't know what it was. I have my questions about what it really was, but whatever. It had 10 to 15 seats, no toilets, and you sat there for 3.5 hours and on a propeller and went there. And that's kind of what happened. That's what all of us rode back then. Now they take military jets.
Was it a lengthy process to get permission?
Yeah, it was. And I had a student, I had a law student do it. And initially, they didn't quite know who I was, but I came off as an author and I kind of wanted to show that they were transparent. And so they kind of let me go. Honestly, I'm not sure they let me go again, but they did that time.
I think you mentioned that you'd spoken to some medical personnel who had worked there. What was their story? How did they view what they had done? And did they acknowledge that when they did surgery, they did it in a way that whoever they were doing the surgery on could be questioned, and it was almost could be argued was a form of torture?
We didn't interview any doctors. We interviewed paramedics, and so they didn't do the surgery. The two people that come to mind, one of them ended up so distraught that he came out of Guantanamo and his parents said, how was it? And he just broke into tears and he wouldn't say a word. And he said he hasn't talked to anybody except us. And then he talked to us. And then afterwards, I asked him, years later, I asked him if somebody else wanted to talk to him. He said, no, I talked to you and I'm done. I can never talk about it again. It was so painful for him as to what he observed. But he didn't participate in that. He just observed it. And the other one became very distraught and needed psychological help when he left, and his wife helped him get through it all. He asked to leave the military earlier. He had a tough time, and what he observed, too, what he did is pass out pills to the detainees, and that was enough for him. It was just it was just too hard for these men. I think a lot of people go down there, they're young, and they're really innocent, and they don't know what the hell they're walking into. And then some of them who are really sensitive.
So do you have any sense of how many U.S. servicemen and other medical personnel that have worked at Guantanamo since in the last 12 years?
No, I think you know, but I will tell you, Robert, since you're talking about this, you might have read about it. There was a nurse, a male nurse, who refused to do forced feeding. I don't know if you heard about hunger strikes. People who hunger strike, they do forced feeding where they put these tubes up the nostrils of the detainees. They force them in a chair, actually. They put them in a chair where they hold their head strapped in, their arms and legs are strapped in so they can't move at all. And then their head is pulled up and they put tubes into their nostrils, into their stomachs, and they pour Ensure down the tubes. And there's some men who have done that for 400. We interviewed someone who did it for 400 plus days. We interviewed him. There's some men we're still trying to interview who's done it for 600 days, and another man did it for longer. It was a nurse who refused to do the force feeding, not a doctor, but a nurse. And he was disciplined by the military. The military almost tried to throw him out to discharge him dishonorably. And he got a lawyer to defend him, and ultimately the military backed down. But that became a recent news, actually, in this past year, where this nurse refused to do the force feeding.
I'm sorry to say this. We have time for one last question. I think this has been fascinating listening to you. And here's the last question. It's from the audience. Do you have any evidence that there's any other facility like Guantanamo, saying, being operated secretly or using any of the methods that the U.S. still operates, either in the United States or abroad?
I don't have any knowledge of that. I will tell you that there used to be a prison in Bagram, Afghanistan, that kept a lot of detainees, and it's still apparently being used, but I have no idea how that's operating, and I haven't read anything to say whether, in fact, there's something else. And I think under Obama, he's trying not to do that, but I don't know.
Okay. Thank you. Our thanks to Professor Peter Jan Honigsberg for his comments today. We also want to thank our listening audiences and our audience here and those on the Internet. I'm Robert Rosenthal, your moderator for today's program, witness to the Guantanamo Project. Now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 112 years of enlightening discussion, is adjourned.